This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. If you're a fan of history or true crime, this hour is for you. I'm joined by Janice Thornton, author of No Place Like Murder, True Crime in the Midwest. Welcome, Janice.
Hey, thanks, Matt. It's good to be here.
By the way, today's show was pre-recorded, so we can't get questions or comments to the author, but the conversation is always open on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Let us know what you think and whether you're interested in picking up the book. So all these crimes took place in Indiana, right?
That is correct. In Indiana between the years 1869 and 1950.
So before we dig into some of the stories that you cover in this book, can I ask you why you decided to write it?
I was kind of interested in historic true crimes. I had discovered a couple of old files down in the basement at the Frankfurt Times where I had worked, you know, like 20 years ago. And I took those clips home with me and I thought, well, someday maybe they'll come in handy for something. And around 2015, I was finishing up a true crime, which was about the unsolved murder of my high school classmate from 1965. And as I was finishing that up, I was sort of sad that I didn't have another true crime project to work on. So that's when I got the idea that I would start writing these short historic true crimes.
What was the book that you referred to earlier about your classmate? What was that story?
Her name was Olean. She went on a date on a Saturday night in October 1965. And she didn't come home. She had driven her car, and they found her car parked three blocks from her house and no sign of what had happened. And they found her body 3 days later, about 10 miles out in the country on a remote country road. And she had been dead for a number of hours, never solved.
Never solved. Did you uncover anything in that book that was surprising to you?
I did all the research that was available. I followed every lead. You know, none of the files or any of the evidence is still available. Everything is gone. The only thing that's, you know, is still available are the rumors and people's opinions. So at the time I started working on that case, it was in the mid-2000s, there were still some people around who had worked the case. Even though there were no files or evidence, I was able to get in touch with a couple of the people involved. What I obtained from those interviews is more than was available prior to that, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So I was able to piece things together. And mostly I wanted to preserve the story. I wasn't trying to solve the case. I just wanted to record everything that was knowable so that maybe someday somebody would be able to put it together.
Did it allow you, though, to draw any conclusions or suspicions? And are your suspicions matched by others who have followed the case closely?
I was able to confirm my suspicions, and then I talked with a couple of other law enforcement officers who had looked into the case, and they had came up with the same conclusions, independent of me.
So when it comes to this book, you had already warmed up to writing true crime with the previous book, but is writing true crime difficult for you in any way? I mean, there's some really sad and grisly stories in here.
I didn't find it difficult to write the stories. I found them fascinating. And for me, it was all about preserving the stories too, or bringing them back. I thought these horrible tragedies had happened, you know, some of them over 100 years ago, and the people had long been forgotten. And so in a way, I thought it was a way of remembering these people so that they're not forgotten.
Let's start with a particularly heinous crime that you wrote about in the book. And this one actually took place in my home county, Dearborn County. I had never heard of this. The massacre on Lowthree Creek. What happened there in May of 1941?
It was a Friday in May of 1941, and a couple of farmers, Harry Sellers and his son Bill, wanted to go out and plow their field. So they went out there to get to work, and they found the cows from the Johnson Agri Farm, which was next door. And they could tell that the cows hadn't been milked for a day or so. So they thought that was curious. So they went over to find out what was going on, walking up the path to the Agru farmhouse, and they found Mr. Agru lying in the path, and he had been shot in the head. Of course, they were very shocked and upset, didn't know what to do, so they hurried on until they found the Agru's 11-year-old niece lying by the barn door, and she had also been shot. So they rushed back to their own house and called the sheriff.
What happened when the sheriff came?
Well, they came up. I believe they threw in some tear gas to the farmhouse because they weren't sure what was going on. You know, they were trying to be very cautious. And when the air cleared, they went inside and they found Mrs. Agru lying on the kitchen floor, also shot. So they began looking around the farm, and it took them quite a bit of time, but they finally found the two sons also shot out in the field where they had been working.
Five victims. And word got around about the tragedy. A crowd gathered at the house. Who was among that crowd?
Well, there's a man named Dink Carter who was there, who was the Agru family's son-in-law. Dink, he went by Dink. His name was Virginius, and his nickname was Dink. So he was with the crowd. They were curiosity seekers, more or less. And he caught the attention of the sheriff, who thought that he just acted odd. So he took him in on suspicion that he might have had some information about it.
So you say that Dink was a son-in-law of the Agrus, but his association with this family gets a little complicated. Can you explain some of that?
Well, you might call it complicated that his previous marriage had been to a different daughter, a different Agru daughter.
Then that marriage didn't work out and he married her sister?
Yes, that first marriage didn't work out. So he married Leona, who happened to be the twin sister of one of the brothers that Dink had murdered.
Mm. You described Dink Carter as unsavory in the book. What else had he done in the past?
Well, he had served some time. He had served 2 years at the Indiana State Farm for auto theft, but even worse, he served 2 more years at the Kentucky State Reformatory for sexually assaulting a minor. Mm. So it doesn't get much more unsavory than that, does it?
Well, I suppose not. So the police took him in for questioning, as you said. How did that go? What happened?
Well, at first, he denied everything. The next day, they took him to Indianapolis and gave him a lie detector test. His answers were hazy and it was inconclusive. So he came back to Dearborn County and sheriff began to interrogate him masterfully. And he got what he wanted. He told him, you know, we've got you on the spot. You'd just as well tell me everything. And pretty soon he did.
Did he offer any motive for the killings?
He was never very clear on that. It seems like that there was something about $10, a $10 loan. And I'm not real clear. It was never clearly stated why he had done that. But I think there was some animosity between him and the family.
His wife, Leona, was at his side during the trial, but she didn't really seem to know what was going on.
No, I think she acted rather clueless because she stuck by Dink the whole time, denying that he had anything to do with it. I mean, she believed him, his denials, and, you know, stand by your man.
The widow of one of his victims, the sister-in-law of Leona Agru, Beatrice Agru, gave a memorable testimony. What did she say about Dink Carter?
She gave a heart-rending testimony and described an argument between Dink and her husband over the sale of pickles. Carter, or Dink, believed that her husband William had cheated him and threatened to get even. And he even told her husband, I'll cut your guts out.
Oof. During the trial, the janitor found his way into Dink Carter's cell. This was literally while one of the hearings was happening. What did the janitor find?
Well, he went in and discovered that Dink was preparing to escape, he had found a rope and he had cut out some of the bars on the window, and he had planned to slip through that window, lower himself down with that rope that I think he cut it from under his bed, and then he was going to catch a freighter out of town. But the janitor let the sheriff know right away what was going on. But Dink had I believe he had told the sheriff, well, I'd rather die from your bullet than the electric chair.
Dink Carter later said that he hadn't meant to confess, this confession that he gave, that he was coerced. Did the jury at the trial buy it?
No, they didn't buy it. That was his defense, that he had been coerced. You know, after I think it had been like 48 hours of questioning before they finally broke him. And so he was using that as an excuse for, you know, just being under pressure and just didn't know what else to do but say he did it, to put an end to it.
What was Dink Carter's sentence?
Well, they found him guilty of first-degree murder, and punishment was death in the electric chair.
His wife, Leona, visited the governor twice to plead for her husband's life. Did he do anything about it?
No. I thought it was interesting that just before he was to be executed, which was February 9th, 1942, the state switched over from standard time to daylight savings time. And so then there was a controversy over whether should he die standard time or daylight savings time? So they ultimately allowed him to live the extra hour.
He was executed, and his body was then shipped back home to Aurora, Indiana. Where was he buried?
Yes, he was buried in Riverview Cemetery, not very far from the five graves of the Agra family that he had murdered. They're just up the hill, and I thought it was fitting that they can look down on him.
We're speaking with Janice Thornton, author of No Place Like Murder, True Crime in the Midwest. When we come back, more from the new book. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking with Janice Thornton, author of No Place Like Murder, True Crime in the Midwest. And Janice, let's look at the story of Isabel Messmer from Elwood, Indiana. What did the newspapers call her?
Oh, they called her Gun Girl.
Why did they call her that?
They gave her that name from an incident that happened in It was in Pittsburgh. It was in 1933. She had picked up some belongings that she had been keeping in a locker at the bus station, and which included a gun that she took out of the locker and put in her purse. And she headed back for her hotel room. She didn't know that she was being followed by two plainclothes Pittsburgh police detectives. As soon as she got in her room, these two men burst in, demanded her gun, and she started fighting with them and, punching and kicking. And they gave her a really hard time before they finally were able to get her and downstairs and get her in their car. And she was kicking and screaming the whole way. But it's important to point out here that Isabel was 18 years old. She was a tiny little thing, and she was just as cute as a bug and very feisty and had a personality. So when they get to the police station, she kind of wins over the police chief, I think, because the next day there's a photograph in the local paper of Isabel and the police chief sitting at his desk facing each other, and they're pointing guns at each other, grinning. And, it's real cute, but, kind of strange. And so that's when they dubbed her Gun Girl. And that picture goes viral, and it's, you know, coast to coast. So from then on, that was her name.
She kept getting into and out of trouble. What were a few of the reasons? What were a few of the crimes that she committed?
After she left Pittsburgh, she went down to Miami, where she quickly got in trouble for stealing $900 in an armed robbery. She got hauled off to jail, but I guess because she was so cute, they let her go. And then 8 months later, she ended up in Washington, D.C., where she was attired in boys' clothing and armed with a pistol. I'm not sure what she was doing, but they picked her up and took her to the psychiatric ward, and they deemed her just an adventurous, irresponsible romancer that enjoyed notoriety. So I think they let her go again.
How did she get into prison the first time? I guess she got into some trouble in New Jersey.
Yeah, it was in January 1938. She was resisting arrest when she was driving away from some traffic policemen, I think, and they were on a 10-mile highway chase at reaching speeds of 80 miles an hour.
Wow.
And the officers actually fired shots before they managed to force her off the road and arrest her. So they found her guilty of assault and battery. She told the judge that she'd mistaken the officers for gangsters, but the judge told her that her days of relying on her pretty face and her cute personality were over, and he sentenced her to 7 years in the New Jersey Women's Prison, which was a minimum security facility, which she walked out of just a few months later, less than a year later. She just walked away.
This was an escape.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
She escaped. But I mean, she just walked away.
So what happened next?
Well, I believe that the next time she made the news, she was in St. Louis. She was arrested for carrying a concealed gun. And then they found out that she was wanted at that New Jersey reformatory. So she put up a fuss and she confessed to killing somebody, Buford Armstrong, in Odessa, Texas. She said she would rather do that than go back to prison.
And in that murder, she pleaded not guilty because she said she killed him out of self-defense. She claimed he was trying to rape her. And that didn't seem to work for the jurors. How did she react then when the verdict was handed down?
The guilty verdict was handed down. She started yelling that, you won't take me back. You won't take me back. I will not go back to that penitentiary. And she jumped up on the courtroom railing and was screaming at the matron, you won't take me back. I will not go back to that penitentiary. And she toppled forward and spectators caught her and helped the police constrain her. But she wouldn't go quietly. The newspaper said that she was fighting like a tiger woman all the way back to her cell.
What ended up being her punishment?
Her punishment for murder was a slap on the wrist. Really, she got 3 years.
3 years.
But once again, she escaped.
Again?
She escaped again. And I think this is the time that they finally caught her in Tipton.
Back home in Indiana. She had made it back home?
Back home again in Indiana. Yeah, Tipton, which is 10 miles to the west of her hometown of Elwood. And she had been hanging out in one of the movie theaters. I think somebody had recognized her and they went in to get her, and she put up a fight, but they got her in jail. They sent a wire to the Odessa sheriff who flew in with his deputy, and the Tipton sheriff met the Odessa sheriff down at the Indianapolis airport and flew her back to Odessa, where she escaped again.
But this whole time when she was found herself in jail again back in Tipton, all the way through to the transport back to Texas, she was really putting up a lot of, well, she was fighting. She was screaming.
She was fighting. She even tried to strangle her mother in the jail cell. And she was just out of control.
when she was transferred to Texas, she escaped again. How long was she on the lam this time?
When she got back to Odessa, she escaped again in November. So she was there from June through November when she escaped, and they picked her up for the final time in San Francisco in April.
Was that the end of her streak, did it seem?
Yeah. When they picked her up in San Francisco and brought her back, they drove. And it was those few days of that road trip, she changed. She changed her mind. I guess that's when she decided. I would have loved to have been there to hear the conversations, because she changed. She settled down. She got back and she said, I'm ready to finish out my punishment. So she finished out her time, although they cut it in half. Her 3-year sentence was cut in half. And then they sent her back to New Jersey. She completed her sentence over there. And then after that, except for, I was only able to find one more article written about her, and that was in 1947. It was just a look back, you know, to retell her story. But I couldn't find another thing in any newspaper about her. And people in Elwood still talk about her. And the rumor is that she went straight. She went to Florida, got married, and just lived a quiet life. And that was it.
Wow. Let's talk about the first two men ever given the chair in Indiana. First, let's talk about the conversation around capital punishment back at that time. This is in the second decade of the 20th century. This is in the middle of the 19-teens. So what were the opinions like at that time, and where were they coming from?
Well, in Indiana, I don't think that they had had any hangings since 1907. They had hanged 13 men between 1897 and 1907. And from that point on, there were no more hangings. Around 1912, the electric chair was coming into use throughout the country. And one of the state legislators got the idea that we should have one in Indiana. So that was in January of 1913 that he introduced his bill. And it passed. But at the time, Harry Ralston, who was the governor of that time, was not a big supporter of the death penalty. And it was my impression from what I read in my research that the majority of the people in Indiana were against the death penalty, which I found very interesting.
But he still had to... He had to procure an electric chair, which we'll get to in a little bit. But let's talk about the first two men to sit in it. John Chirca, what did he do?
John Chirca lived with his family in Indiana Harbor, which is a small community in Lake County. So on the morning of May 15th, he bursts through the back door into the kitchen, where his wife is sitting at the kitchen table with her two tenants, and he was drunk and he was yelling, and he demanded that his wife give him 15 cents so that he could buy a ticket to their daughter's school program the next evening. So his wife, Mary, was used to I called it his lack of civility. And so she just tried to go along with it, didn't want to start a fight. So she got up and went into the next room to find her purse to get some change to give him. And he followed her, and they were in the bedroom, and he whirled around and he pointed a 38 Smith & Wesson at her and fired two shots point blank. The first hit her in the side, the second in the chest, and she ran out of the room. He shot her a third time in the back, which killed her instantly.
He was found guilty. The judge sentenced him to death by electrocution. Here is where we turn to a story out of Terre Haute. What happened there about a week and a half before John Chirca was sentenced?
Right, just before he was sentenced, Harry Rosico traveled from where he lived in Vincennes. He traveled to Terre Haute, where his wife had taken off a few days before with their, 18-month-old son. she wanted to visit her family. Well, he rushed up there. He got it in his head that she was cheating on him or something. And he confronted her and shot her in the head as she was begging him not to kill her because she was pregnant. She was begging for her life and the life of her unborn child, and he shot her in the head.
Mm. You write that Harry Rosico seemed to enjoy the terror and the anguish that he instilled in his wife before he killed her. I mean, that's unbelievable. What happened next, though, is terrible. What did he do after he killed her?
He turned and walked back into the house, into the bedroom, where his little son, 18-month-old son, was lying in bed, and he shot him in the chest. The shot got the attention of a police officer who ran in and arrested him on the spot and called for medical treatment. But the little boy died on the way to the hospital.
And Harry Rosico required round-the-clock monitoring in jail. Why was that?
Because right after he killed his wife, he killed his son, and then he turned the gun on himself. Unfortunately, the bullet was a dud, so he was suicidal. So he required round-the-clock monitoring to make sure that he didn't try to kill himself.
And this part was chilling to me when I read it. He went to the judge for his sentencing once that came around, and he found out that he was sentenced to death and he was going to be electrocuted. What did he then do when he got back to his cell?
Yeah, he was escorted back to his jail cell, where he just resumed his game of solitaire.
Just remorseless, emotionless.
Yes.
So we got into the feelings around capital punishment at that time. And as you said, Sam Ralston, the governor at the time, opposed the death penalty. But he had these two men who were sentenced to death by electric chair, and there was no electric chair yet. What did the governor do about that?
Well, they got the electric chair after the men were sentenced. So he had to postpone their executions until the electric chair was installed. So I think he postponed it about a month. He postponed it from January to mid-February of 1914.
And he also had to find a way to pay for the electric chair. How did he do that?
It was not budgeted, so he had to take the money out of his contingency fund.
And he, again, was against the death penalty, but he had to do this. Up until this point, the two men had nothing to do with each other. How did the night of their execution go?
That night, at the stroke of midnight on February 20th, Rosico went first, and he was accompanied by a prison guard and a pastor. He walked out of his cell and headed down the hall toward the chamber. The papers reported that he projected a calm demeanor as he was strapped into the chair and everything was all hooked up. And at 12:07, the warden signaled the executioners to drop the switch, and they did. They delivered 2,300 volts of electricity through his body, and he was pronounced dead at 12:15, and his body was taken out. And then 10 minutes later, at 12:25, Chirka took his first step, out of his jail cell, and he went down that long hallway. He was strapped in, and he got the electrical currents went through him at about 12:30. And they had to give it to him twice. They gave him two zaps, and they pronounced him dead at 12:58 a.m.
So it worked.
I thought it was interesting that Governor Ralston had made it clear that he personally did not favor the death penalty, but he went ahead with it because that was his job. Justice prevailed, he said, despite the petitions that were delivered to him bearing signatures of 17,000 Indiana citizens who were calling for him to spare the lives of these two men.
Wow. Things don't change much, even in more than 100 years. Capital That's punishment right. is still a divisive and talked about issue, to be sure. We're talking with Janice Thornton. She's the author of No Place Like Murder, True Crime in the Midwest. And up next, we'll share the story of Frankie Miller and the crime of passion that happened in Frankfurt back in 1950. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're joined by Janice Thornton, author of No Place Like Murder, True Crime in the Midwest. And Janice, let's get to the story of Frankie Miller. This one takes place on March 18th, 1950, or at least it starts on that date. A man named Leland Holiday is sitting in a bar in Frankfort, Indiana, called the Marine Room. There's a basketball game on. He's a Hoops fan, but he isn't interested in the game. What has his attention instead?
It's a woman that he just met there. She's new in town, and things have been progressing quickly. So she has all of his attention.
His girlfriend, Frankie Miller, was used to this sort of thing, him talking to other women. How did she find out what he was up to?
Well, Frankie had gotten off her job at 8 o'clock. She was a telephone operator, and she went over to Leland's apartment and expecting to find him there, and he wasn't. So she waited, you know, about an hour, and then she was starting to think something is amiss. So she called the Marine Room. It's one of Leland's favorite bars in town. And when the waitress answered, Frankie asked her if Lee was there. She didn't want to talk to him. She just wanted to know if he was there. And the waitress said yes. And Frankie asked, well, is he alone? And the waitress reluctantly told her, no, he's not alone. So Frankie hung up the phone and she was just furious. And as the time went on, her anger just intensified until she looked out the window at around 10 o'clock. And here comes Leland walking up the street with this woman that Frankie didn't know.
What did she do next?
When she saw Leland open his car door and let the woman slide in the front seat, Frankie just lost it. She went storming downstairs and confronted them. She yelled at the woman to get out of the car, and she started yelling at Leland. And he told her, you know, just cool it, and I'm going to do what I want to do. And Frankie, you know, threw her hands up, and she says, well, I know what you're going to do, and believe me, you're going to be sorry. Ooh. And she stormed back upstairs, and she prepared for what she was going to do next.
I understand she tore up the apartment a little bit. She kind of ruined some things in his apartment.
Right. She poured Coke and beer all over the place. She got out their love letters and threw them all over the kitchen floor and poured more, you know, beer on those. And then she went to the closet and got out Leland's shotgun and loaded it. And then she made herself comfortable on the couch to wait.
And he finally came home about 1:30 in the morning. He found the mess. He found Frankie. What happened next?
Mm-hmm. Well, he walks into the kitchen and looks around, and he kind of looks over his shoulder at her and says, well, you kind of messed things up, didn't you? And with that, she stands up and points the gun at him, and she shoots him. She shoots him right in the back of the neck, and he hits the floor. And Frankie's last words to him was, "I love you," but he was already dead.
How did the police get a confession? What did she do right after she killed him?
As soon as Frankie shot Lee, for a moment considered shooting herself, but then she changed her mind. She ran uptown to the police station and ran inside and told the night officer what she had done. She says, "I just killed Lee." And she waited there while some officers ran back to the apartment, and they found him lying on the kitchen floor, face down, with a hole in his throat and blood all around him.
The police had their confession. They had the evidence. They had the crime scene. She was indicted on first-degree murder charges. By now, the newspapers had gotten a hold of the story, and some of the reporting was a little sexist. What did they focus on?
Yes, it was just the kind of story that, you know, readers like. It was very salacious. The press presented Frankie, who I want to point out was just an ordinary woman who, I mean, she was very sweet, attractive, but not a movie star. But the press presented her as a torrid, shapely blonde and a buxom divorcee.
Late May rolled around. The trial began. The prosecutor wanted life in prison for Frankie, not the death penalty. Her defense attorneys had an uphill battle to fight because of her confession and some of the things that she had said in it. But Chief Counsel Frank Pryor had a way of doing things that ramped up the drama, and it was very effective. He really whipped the courtroom into a frenzy. How did he do it?
He presented the case as not as murder, because he claimed there was no premeditation. And without that, there was no murder charge. He tried to present Frankie as the victim. And Frank Pryor did have a flair for dramatics and would get right up in people's faces as he was questioning them, and very theatrical.
Frankie had a twin brother, and he, along with Frankie's father, took the witness stand and said that Frankie had been abused by Leland. What seemed to back that up?
What backed that up was the testimony by the Boone County Sheriff, who told the court that when Frankie came in to the jail, that she had bruises on her arms and neck, and that one of her breasts looked red.
At the end of the month at the trial, Frankie herself took the witness stand. How did that go?
The Frankfurt Morning Times reported that Frankie had overshadowed everything that occurred prior in that courtroom. And the paper reported her testimony as very impressive, partly because of her demeanor and partly because of an air that was refinement, they said, even in the face of questions that called for a humiliating confession.
Mm. And her big play was what happened with the jury behind closed doors. What did she do?
Well, she claimed that that she had been burned, that Leland had burned her breast. So she and the jury went to a private room where she showed them the scars.
She basically bared her breast, in front
yes.
of the jury. And that was reported in the papers, right?
Most of the papers. Oddly, it was not reported in the Frankfurt Times for some reason that I've never understood, but all the other papers did report that.
The jury reached a verdict. What was it?
They found her guilty of manslaughter. The punishment for manslaughter is 2 to 21 years, which would, you know, was far better than the life sentence that she faced for murder.
How long was she in prison?
She served 2 years and pretty much faded into obscurity.
When she was released, though, did the papers report on that?
Not a word. The editor at the Frankfurt Times, who had been covering her case from day one, had covered it from day one. By the time that she had been sentenced, he had passed away. So when she was released 2 years later, he wasn't there, and there was no one who was still following the case. So it went unreported in Frankfurt, believe it or not.
What did the rest of her life look like?
I did as much research as was possible on some online databases, and I found that she, after she got out, she moved to Kokomo and married and lived a very quiet life. There was nothing reported about her after I found that she had, you know, taken out a marriage license, and she died in 1993. I found her obituary. She died at age 72. And I believe that very few people who knew her at that time knew that she was the infamous Frankie Miller, who had, you know, 45 years before had made newspaper headlines coast to coast. Mm.
So that's Frankie Miller. Next is Ferry McLean Miller. And for this story, we're going to go back over 100 years, 1908. And this takes place in Kokomo. Tell me about Ferry McLean Miller. What kind of person was she?
Ferry McLean was kind of a free spirit. She was young and attractive, twice divorced. She had flaming red hair and just tons of it.
She could have had almost any man she wanted. She chose a man who went by the name Pete Osborne. What was he like?
It was my opinion, based on what I read about him, that he was a kind of a loser. He was about 33 years old. He was a big guy. He came from a really good family in Greentown. His father was a well-known farmer in the area, had served on the Howard County commissioners. But he was just kind of, he didn't work. He drank a lot.
How did he treat Ferry?
Well, I don't think that he treated her very well. Now, he was being a loser. He loved being seen with Ferry. But when they were alone, he seemed to be abusive, and she filed a charge against him for hitting her at one point, and eventually she broke it off.
He got drunk after she broke up with him, came to her house late on a Tuesday night in early April 1908. What happened?
Well, Ferry was staying at her aunt's house, and her nephew was also there. And it was about 10 o'clock, and they were all in bed, but there was pounding at the front door. So Ferry got up to answer it and found that it was Pete there. And she just turned around and he walked in. Now, he was a frequent visitor there. At one point, he even rented a room in that house. So he was well known, and no one had any reason to be afraid of him. So Ferry was just kind of annoyed that he was there, and she just turned around and walked back and climbed back in bed. And he followed her, and he wanted to talk.
She didn't want to talk. And instead, what did he decide he would settle for?
Well, he wanted a kiss. And Ferry told him to get away, and he just got up, you know, real close in her face, and she pushed him away. And see, he kind of grabbed her wrist, and she said, now get away from me, or if you don't, I'm going to, first thing in the morning, I'm going to tell your father what you've done. And that is what set him off. He's quoted as saying to her, "Ferry, you vex me so." I just love that quote. And he reached in his pocket and pulled out a gun, and he shot her twice in the face.
What did Pete Osborne do afterward?
Well, he ran away. Ferry's aunt called the police, and they came over and, you know, saw what had happened. And the sheriff launched a manhunt, which lasted 10 days. That night, the sheriff ran out, you know, on horseback to Greentown to talk with Pete's parents. And they didn't know anything about what had happened, and they had no idea where he was. They hadn't seen him for quite some time. So for the next 10 days, the law enforcement pursued every lead. They questioned all of Pete's friends, and they even offered a $500 reward, which I believe at that time was quite hefty. But they came up with nothing until April 17th, which was 10 days after the shooting. The sheriff got a call from the Logansport Railroad yards that he had been spotted, And the sheriff immediately went over there, found him, and brought him back to Kokomo, and he was under arrest.
So he was missing for 10 days. What did he do in that time?
When he got back to Kokomo, he immediately confessed, but then he had an interview with a reporter from the Kokomo Tribune, and he told the whole story of what he had been doing for the past 10 days. And so apparently the first night, right after he shot Ferry, he did go to his parents' house, although they didn't know it, and he hid out in the barn, and he stayed there from that first night through the next day until dusk the next night before he revealed himself to his parents. So he goes in, tells them what happened. He filled up on his mother's cooking and asked his dad for money. And he headed north to Wabash, where he jumped a train north to Michigan. And he went all the way up in northern Michigan. And he ended up in a small mill town. And as soon as he got off the train, he looked around and he knew he was in trouble. It was freezing cold and the ground was covered with snow. He wasn't qualified for a job at a mill. And not only that, but he realized that everybody up there had to, you know, shoot their own food. You know, and he wasn't prepared to shoot a deer or even a squirrel. So he knew that if he stayed there, he was going to starve to death. So he told the reporter, "All that took the sand out of me," and he headed for home. He thought he would first go to his parents' house and ask for their advice before he turned himself in. But Logansport was as far as he got.
He was caught and brought in. And then for the sake of his parents, what did he do?
Yeah, he didn't want to put his parents through the shame and humiliation of a trial. So he pleaded guilty, and he worked out a deal with the judge that if he would plead guilty, that the judge would give him second-degree murder, which would only call for the life in prison rather than a death sentence.
After he was sentenced to life in prison, what did he tell the reporters?
He said that he planned to be a model prisoner in hopes that one day that would set him free. And the day before he left Kokomo on his, you know, for the train ride up to Michigan City to prison, he asked to speak with his reporter friend one more time. And during that interview, he thanked the local law enforcement for treating him so kindly, and he expressed appreciation to all the people who had showered him with fruits and flowers during his stay at the jail. I know it's crazy. And at the time, then he took that moment to offer a few words of advice and warning to all the boys and young men of Kokomo not to drink alcohol for fear that they would land on the same path that he followed.
Did he live up to those promises of staying away from whiskey and being a model prisoner?
He did. He was the prison warden did say that he was a model prisoner. And consequently, he had been up for parole several times between 1913 and 1919. But each time he was turned down because Miller's family were there to protest his release.
Did he ever end up getting out?
July 26, 1920, when he died of acute appendicitis.
Ah, so he didn't get out.
Well, he got out, but it wasn't the way he had planned.
Janice Thornton is the author of the new book, No Place Like Murder, True Crime in the Midwest, and it is full of these kinds of stories. Janice, this is such a great book. Congrats on it, and thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, well, thank you so much for this opportunity.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer, and he composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.